Agenda paper three.
Thank you. So we'll move to agenda paper three now. The committee received a submission about how an entity applies IFRS 9 to a particular contract to buy or sell a non-financial item in the future at a fixed price. The submitter describes two fact patterns in which an entity accounts for such contracts as derivatives at fair value for P&L, but nonetheless physically settles the contract. The submission assumes the entity has an accounting policy of recognizing gross revenue on physical settlement to reflect the sale of inventory. We would highlight that our analysis does not cover the accounting for the physical settlement of the contracts more broadly, nor suggest that an entity is required to recognize revenue on a gross basis. Instead, we have analyzed only the question asked by the submitter, that is, whether it is appropriate for an entity to make an additional entry that reverses the accumulated gain or loss previously recognized in profit or loss on the derivative and recognizes a corresponding adjustment to either revenue in the case of sale contract or inventory in the case of a purchase contract. Paragraph 33 to 35 of the paper include a summary of the outreach conducted, and paragraphs 36 to 46 include our analysis of the matter. For the reasons explained in the paper, we think IFRS 9 neither permits nor requires an entity to make the additional journal entry described in the submission. I would now like to pause and direct your attention to the question on page 12 and ask whether the committee agrees with our analysis of the requirements in IFRS 9.
Okay, and this is a situation where we definitely don't have hedge accounting happening, right? Okay, who wants to talk about IFRS 9? Wonderful IFRS standard.
Oh. I agree with the staff's analysis, but I wanted to add, I've recently come across a situation in which entities get the same accounting as what's described, but don't do the additional journal entry, and I think we need to address that in the agenda decision. So what happens is, let's take the forward contract for sale. They have the forward contract for sale. They're marking it to market through P&L and the line item in P&L. When the item, when it settles, they recognize revenue for the amount of cash in the contract. They don't include the contract in the consideration of for the sale. And so they're left with the derivative on the balance sheet, and then they have to write that off. And they write it off through the same line item that they've been recognizing gains and losses. So they look at it and say, well, I'm not in this situation because I'm not recording the additional journal entry. But in effect, they are. So my recommendation would be to make clear in the agenda decision at the bottom of page 14 and the top of page 15, those two bullet points, that the consideration received in a sale or the consideration paid when you get the inventory includes the fair value of the derivative.
So I think just to clarify, Bob, it's almost like in paragraph 40 of the paper, we kind of talk about that. We say the contract was settled by receipt or delivery of the commodity, blah, 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 in exchange for a derivative of 10 plus
yes.
cash. So I think you're saying if we could bring some of that into the agenda decision.
Tony.
Yeah, I agree with the staff's analysis and with the conclusion. At the risk of repeating something I said at the last meeting in a different context, I think you need to account for the transaction that you have, not the transaction you might have had. And in this case, you have a derivative. That derivative runs its course and gets settled. And maybe at the same time, there is a physical delivery of goods that results in the recognition of revenue. But there are two things happening. And the derivative is being settled. And so I hadn't come across the situation that Bob described, but I was going to suggest anyway, and I'd spoken to Petrina, that it will be helpful to explain in the agenda decision that the derivative is being settled when it comes to an end.
Okay, thank you. Bertrand.
I agree with the staff analysis, but I was brought by two preparers in France the following concern. Actually, it's not that they disagree with the staff analysis in the sense in reversing the additional journal entry. It's more in the way they present their P&L. So we are not in an onus transaction. We are not in a hedge accounting transaction. Still, it's hedging. And what they consider economical hedging, even if it's not hedge accounting. But never mind. What they say is it's not an IFRS 15 transaction. It's an IFRS 9 transaction. You pointed it out, Sue. And then when it comes to reflecting the entries that are described, I don't remember exactly on which page, but maybe we can, on page 5. So cash, obviously, derivative liability. So the debit side of the journal entries is pretty clear. And then what they do is they account for credit 100 in revenue, in IFRS 15 revenue, that will impact ultimately EBITDA for them as a non-GAAP measure. And the 10 is in other revenue, an other revenue line, which is not impacting EBITDA. And so, I don't know, honestly, on this, I don't know what to think. I have just a question. Do you intend, when you say revenue, do you intend or do you mean IFRS 15 revenue, strictly speaking? Do you mean just in one line of revenue? Is it really what is intended by the tentative agenda decision? Or could they split their revenue line in two as they are currently doing? So it's just a question. So
I can tell you, Bertrand, our intentions in the staff paper, at least in terms of what we were addressing and not addressing.
Yes.
So we tried to very clearly, both in setting out the facts and in how we've worded the tentative agenda decision, to once again focus the analysis and focus the question for you as the committee on the question asked, which was very much about that additional journal entry. We were not asked about, nor did we intend to give any opinions about the what you might call either gross or net accounting or what that revenue is. So, for example, we were not intending, we were specifically put it as an assumption in the facts, an assumption in the facts in the agenda decision, that the entity has an accounting policy of recognising a gross revenue number, but we didn't even then go on to mention whether that's IFRS 15 revenue or not. So at least in terms of our intentions and what this would address, was this would address only the additional journal entry and make no comment on, you know, how the revenue number, first of all, whether gross revenue could be recognised or not, or whether that would be IFRS 15.
The reason I wanted to bring this question also here is because on paragraph 15, when you describe the entry, there is no footnote. Whereas on paragraph 12 and 14, there is a footnote mentioning or other appropriate line item in the statement of profit or loss. So it might be understood as if these footnotes would not apply to paragraph 13 or paragraph 15, which is, I mean, for paragraph 13, it is not their issue because they I think, from what I've understood from my discussions with them, they effectively understand that you need to do some kind of basis adjustment, even though it's not, strictly speaking, hedge accounting. Fine. I think they don't discuss the purchase side of the question. It's more the reflection in the P&L of the revenue.
So we used.
So if we could add a nuance on that, but I'm not sure. I think it would conflict maybe with Robert's comments, who was far more strict on that. So, yeah. And by the way, in the tentative agenda decision, it's something I mentioned to the staff. But I think the before the last paragraph, I think this sentence could be suppressed. I mean, consequently, the committee concluded that the additional journal entry described in the request is inconsistent with the requirements in IFRS 9. Even if it's the case, if you point it, if you write it like that, some enforcers might think that the preparer should do a correction of an error or something like that. Yeah.
Well spotted, Bruce.
Thanks. I kind of got to the same answer, but maybe just a bit more of a simplistic way. Maybe it's just the way I work. When I kind of read the scoping paragraph, I mean, to me, this is I've always seen the scoping exclusion as a dual test. Okay, it requires two things. It requires you to enter into something and to continue to hold it. So to me, the fact that if you're in the stage where you're saying, well, we've entered into this contract, and on day one, your intention is not to take physical delivery, I don't know how you can get to a stage later on where now you're trying to reapply something or at a later date. And I guess the question there comes into, in my mind, is does the scoping exclusions only apply in initial recognition, or can somebody apply a scoping exclusion later on? And I mean, not that I think we can address that question now, because I think that could be a much bigger general question.
You think that's simpler?
I don't think that's a simple question. But I'm saying, for me, on the fact pattern that's been put here, to me the question was actually more around the intention at the moment you enter into. And to me, that's the dual test. Step one says, have you entered into this contract with the intention of physical delivery or not? The moment, to me, they've made that decision on day one that it hasn't, I think you failed that, and it doesn't apply.
So you land in the same place.
I land in the same place. I just think when you get to the agenda decision, I think we've really drawn that out.
Jim?
I agree with this staff analysis, and I think IFRS 9 is very clear on this issue. And I also see the through some of the comments just made here, the risk of calling it IFRS 15 revenue, because IFRS 15 governs the term revenue. That's it. We don't have a IFRS 15 revenue or 13 revenue or 9 revenue. So it's a revenue. I see that the world is learning about this, the newly issued standards. They're trying to fit them back into whatever they have been doing before. So we, throughout our agenda decisions or our wording, we should prevent them from this way of thinking. We don't let them just think, okay, it's a new 15, this line item called 15 revenue, and then I'll put whatever I've been doing before through some other revenue lines called other revenue. There's no other revenue. So I think that's the agenda paper 2 and 3 are telling us. They are learning about the new rules, and we don't give them additional ways. So these two requests are quite clear. They know what the rule is telling them to do, and they're trying to do something more than the rule. So we should let them know. It's all of it, so don't think about additional further steps. This we cannot just list whatever they could do next. There's no next.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Interesting. Martin?
If I had to account for that transaction, I would have accounted for it in the way this staff proposed it. So I'm in agreement with this staff. And main argument for me is what was also labeled out in paragraph 28. So more or less, if you have the ability to settle it net, and you would do so and then would sell the commodities on the market, you could probably end up with the same result. And I would not open up that accounting opportunities, whereas economically, more or less, I come to the same result. However, as I'm supportive for the agenda decision, I believe for this specific agenda decision, we really do not have so much substance in a way out of the standard, because I mean, if you also read through the staff paper, it's a lot of we think, the committee observed, and then the committee concluded. So that means probably that's the reason for interpretation, but really it's on very, very soft substance.
Andrew?
Thanks.
I agree with the staff analysis. I think that the additional journal entry would really have the effect of retrospective application of the own use exemption. And I, in fact, think that IFRS 9 directs you to decide whether you're in the own use exemption on initial recognition. It says when a contract is entered into, that tells me it's initial recognition. It's a one-time point. If I don't make it at that point, I don't get to go back in again. Otherwise, you're going to get yourself effectively into synthetic hedge counting, which I don't really want to go near. On the point of different types of revenue, I do agree with Jim that you've got IFRS 15, which is new and it's bringing some change, but the scope of IFRS 15 does have its limits. And so you can find that there are some items of revenue don't fall within IFRS 15 that you then need to deal with. For me, this is very clearly revenue from a contract with a customer. And if I go to paragraph 15, I think that is the only way you can do it, because what you are doing is in IFRS 15, you have revenue from a contract with customer, and it is both cash and non-cash consideration. The non-cash consideration is settlement of the derivative liability. So I would see that as the way that you need to do it. On the comment in the penultimate paragraph, when it says it's inconsistent with the requirements of IFRS 9, I think it's actually wider than that. It's inconsistent with the requirements of IFRS, because if you stick in the additional journal, you're going to recognise income and expenditure that doesn't actually exist.
Fundamental. Carl.
I agree with staff's analysis, conclusions, and the wording in general. Have a small concern in the wording in the second to last paragraph, the sentence, those differences reflect differences in the respective accounting requirements. It seems to imply that the accounting requirements is there is no link to other things, but I think we should refer to for example, those accounting difference reflect difference in the respective business practice or respective fact pattern. The way it's written, I think it's implying the accounting. The accounting is like that because it's like that. It's just a small wording concern. I would refer to other than accounting requirements to business practice or a specific fact pattern or something like that.
I thought we were trying to make a slightly different point, though, which was just that based on the outreach, a number of people, some said that, you know, they were doing different things because if it had been this contract, it would have been accounted for this way, or if they had been doing hedge accounting, it would have been accounted for that way. And this was really just acknowledging that if you had a different transaction, you would account for it differently. So,
yeah, that's my comment.
I had a different comment on paragraph 41 of the paper, and also it is repeated in the tentative agenda decision on page 2 of the tentative agenda decision. Starting, the committee also observed that the accounting for contracts that do not meet the own use scope exception in IFRS 9 is different from the accounting for contracts that meet the exception. I was pausing on that in the context of something that qualifies for own use, but we elect to measure at fair value through profit and loss. And I would have naturally thought about that arrangement in a manner quite similar to the analysis for the derivative arrangement. But paragraph 41 and that paragraph in the tentative agenda decision, I was worried could be read to imply something different.
Which isn't what we meant. Yeah. We meant own use accounted for as own use.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair point. I sometimes forget we've made that amendment, that's why. Bonnie?
And maybe one additional point that I think relates to, I think, how the scope of the agenda decision was framed, and this idea that we're not addressing gross or net. If that is an explicit intention of the wording in the agenda decision, it didn't strike me that that was the case. It struck me that we were saying it's gross. And quite frankly, I'm not offended by the agenda decision being read to say it's gross. And so the notion that we're implying you know, net is potentially a policy type decision. I'm pausing on that, and I certainly didn't read the agenda decision in that manner. I'm not sure if others did or not.
I agree with the staff's analysis and the conclusion. The one point that I had kind of reading through the tentative agenda decision was just to clearly state that the unused exemption was met. And perhaps we can cover off a couple of other comments that it wasn't met at contract inception, and that kind of covers off a couple of items. Because it talks about the unused exemption, but it doesn't. We don't explicitly say this agreement does not meet the unused exemption, and therefore it doesn't apply. And then there, kind of in the, let's see, the third paragraph, between the second and the third paragraph, we talk about the unused exemption, and then we just say, we kind of skip over that so we don't explicitly state it. And so I wonder if we could say it doesn't meet it at contract exception, or inception, excuse me, and therefore that covers up a couple of points.
Okay. Gaurav?
Okay. Yeah. I agree with the staff's analysis and the conclusion, and the alternative or the additional journal entry may create a situation something like that, you know, actually that this company is applying some kind of a hedging accounting, that carrying amount of this would be 110 instead of 110. And this implied that this company would acquire this, commodity or something that at the beginning of the contract, and the Fitch is not the represent the situation, and I believe that what happened anyway that the company is not designated this transaction as a hedge, therefore that the company should report that the inventory at 110 instead of 100. That the additional journal entry may rather confuse that the leaders of a financial statement.
Okay, thank you, Gar. Reinhardt, did you have something to add?
No, I agree with the staff agenda analysis and the agenda decision. I think, as others have said, if you don't meet the on-use exemption, you can't account as if you did and do what-if type accounting. So I agree.
Okay, great. Mikhail, are you on the phone? Okay. Right, sorry. So our formal question first. So can I get a show of hands for whether you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add the matter to our standard setting agenda?
That is everyone in the room. And 13.
Okay. So on the agenda decision, I've heard a few things. So Bertrand's point about the wording of that penultimate paragraph about that's inconsistent with, yes. So we need to make that consistent with words.
Can I just make a comment about that? I don't agree with taking it out, and I'll tell you why. I haven't heard anybody say that they think the accounting is consistent with IFRS 9 in any way.
Wording we usually use?
So what I was going to suggest is just that it's Bertrand's right, we don't usually sort of say it in a stark way. So what we were thinking about suggesting is that consequently the committee concluded that IFRS 9 does not permit or require blah, blah, blah.
I'm just saying, I mean,
which hopefully kind of says the same thing, but less.
The reason I'm questioning it is, I mean, from what I've gathered, I don't think anybody in any circumstance can see where this would be permitted by IFRS 9. So I'm trying to say, what would stop us from then saying, guys, we think the accounting here is wrong? Because, I mean, that's my understanding of where we've all got to. Unless I've missed the boat, that anybody could foresee how this would be any different.
If you want to get acceptance for a change, you just need to be smooth in requiring people to change. Otherwise, you get bad reactions. Above all in France.
Yes, marching down the Champs-Élysées. Yeah.
I would prefer that.
We'll let you do that first.
Yeah, I was about to say.
I would rather vote for the smoother way of doing it.
So, sorry, Petrina's suggestion is that sort of in keeping with the usual words we use to say the committee concluded that the additional journal entry described, or IFRS 9 does not permit or require
the additional
journal entry.
Which hopefully says basically the same thing, Bruce, but just in a less...
I was being soft compared to Andrew.
We're being kind. The other suggestion came from Bob, and I think was supported by others, was making it explicit that the derivative is part of the consideration for the settlement. And then we had a suggestion from some, including Bonnie, that we're clear that this assessment of own use is made at inception, and therefore the own use exception does not apply. So trying to capture that point.
I had one additional point noted, which was Guy's point on the sentence that says, you know, to deal with the fact you could meet own use but actually elect to do fair value through PML. So we'll just have a look at the...
Making it clear that we're not in that situation.
I thought I heard one more suggestion, maybe I misheard, but that was making it clear that the company's policy was to recognize gross, so net is not precluded.
That's right. Sorry, thank you. I had that noted and didn't say it. So I think if we can, there are a couple of comments, at least our intention to make the intention clear that in this agenda decision, we are not opining on gross or net in terms of the revenue number. So to make it just clearer, that part of the assumed facts is that this entity, as its accounting policy, recognises revenue on a gross basis.
Fair enough.
Okay, with those clarifications...
Can I just test that in the contract we've got consideration of 100 plus a derivative of 10. So why would you not recognise revenue?
Andrew, you have to speak up.
Oh, I'm sorry. In the contract, I've got cash consideration of 100, and I've got a derivative arising from that contract of 10. So why is my revenue not always 110? Or some suggesting it should be 100 and something else.
No, it's not 100 versus 110. Sorry.
No.
Have I misunderstood the point others were making?
When you record it net, you're recording only gain of 10, not revenue gain.
So once a derivative, always a derivative?
Yeah, fine.
We'll have to be careful to draft it so that it doesn't apply what Andrew was...
Exactly, because it's not at all. We're saying that assuming you've decided that you're going to recognise the gross revenue as opposed to just the gain, then it's definitely 110. It's not...
Just so no one can game it. That's fine.
Guy.
Just on this gross versus net, on the purchase side, I'm not really clear in my mind how it could ever be net, because we're buying something and I have to record the inventory. And to me that kind of speaks to some discomfort on the revenue side with viewing this as net rather than gross. So my natural inclination would have been this should be gross, and my initial reading of the draft tentative agenda decision was suggesting gross, and I wasn't appreciating that we were relying on the submitter having said their policy election was gross rather than net. So my suspicion is if we make that even more clear, that's going to sort of beg further question as to whether or not net is acceptable.
Right. So we'll put it in as an assumption that it's gross on the revenue side, so we'll make it clear that it's not talking about purchase, which I think would address Guy's concern.
Yeah. Your main concern on the, because we agree on the purchase side, it's always inventory.
Okay, so with those clarifications, could I get a show of hands on who supports the tentative agenda decision, please?
2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's everyone in the room. Andrew and her, 13.
Okay.